And again, I'm speaking with Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate and misogyny online, online ethics and folkloric ambivalence across media. She is the co-author of the new book, The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity and Antagonism Online. So we know that Facebook and Google and these giant tech companies that are the new ExxonMobils, and they're getting so powerful, and they'll get more powerful, obviously, that they practice a form of what's called surveillance capitalism, where we have become the product. We think we're getting Gmail for free, but we don't realize that we're being monetized and we get nothing out of it, and they become massively rich as a result. So it seems like we're kind of beleaguered. We're both being commodified and at the same time being sort of, in terms of bread and circuses, distracted by clickbait.
We are. And what is most confusing about the bread and circus of clickbait is that on services like Facebook and Twitter and across social media generally, it is very, very difficult to tell what kind of circus you're actually watching. That there's an internet axiom, and is discussed pretty extensively in the Ambivalent Internet, called Poe's Law. And what that states is that when you are on the internet, it is often impossible to distinguish satirical expression from sincere expression. So you might be on Facebook and you think that you're looking at some sort of hilarious satire of some sort of far right, whatever it is you might be looking at. You might think that it's a joke, and so you might share it because it seems kind of funny to you. However, that could be someone being absolutely sincere in what they're expressing, and so by engaging with it, you are simply amplifying it to who knows what audience, to what end. And so that's also one of the reasons why Facebook in particular has really struggled with content moderation, keeping people safe on the platform, because it is so difficult to tell what you're looking at and when it crosses the line from being satirical to being potentially a danger. And that is something that they have relied on heavily, because legally those are muddy waters to walk into. But it's it's not just that we have circuses. We don't even know what entertainment event we are even at. It could actually be a gladiator match, and we wouldn't even necessarily know it because we don't think that the weapons are real, but they actually are.
So the fact that you see often, like in a restaurant, you see four people sitting in a restaurant, and they're not talking and looking at each other. They're looking at their laps where they have in their hands a device. And it seems to me that more and more people are living vicariously online, and that their real world life may not be as interesting as their sort of fantasy life in cyberspace, or maybe there's a better word than fantasy, but alternative life in cyberspace. So what is driving this? Is it the fact that we have become commodified and relentlessly exploited, and this is a kind of our lives become less meaningful in reality and more meaningful online? Is that a possible explanation?
I mean, yeah, Facebook and these other social media sites, they're in the business of keeping people on their platform. They make more money if you stay on longer. And so there's almost, I used to call this the Facebook imperative, that, you know, you get kind of told this idea that good people are people who share things, right? And the more you share and the more you connect, the better you are and the richer your life is. And maybe that's true to an extent in some cases, but it also is sort of corporate propaganda to get you to continue to live your life as fully on these platforms as you can. So that's a concern. But for me, I think that one of the things that concerns me the most about social media is the way that it fetishizes human experience and emotion and serves as an ethical roadblock. And this is another big point we talk about throughout the book, that the affordances of social media and of digital tools in general, they typically focus on decontextualized content. So you have one singular GIF, or you have a singular mimetic image that's got funny text at the top and the bottom. And it's so easy to forget or to not even ask where something has come from. And so you can basically reduce an entire person's life to one, you know, two second looped video where they're falling off a trampoline, and then you share it with your friends and laugh. So these spaces, through this act of sharing and through context collapse, so not knowing who is in your audience and what impact your sharing might have, that makes it so that it's harder to make ethical decisions, and it's harder to see other people online as fully fleshed out human beings. And I think that really has contributed to, you know, the polarization in online spaces, that people on the left are not encouraged by the affordances of social media. They are not encouraged to see people on the right as people. And people on the right are not encouraged to see people on the left as people. And losing that empathetic connection, which doesn't always happen perfectly offline, but is more likely to because you have context cues, you see someone's expression, you know, you kind of see them as a fully fleshed out human being. When we lose that on social media, and especially if we lose ourselves fully in the sort of online world, we also lose the ability to connect in a meaningful way and to work together through the multiple issues that we are currently facing as a democracy.
So we're certainly a long way from those paintings of Norman Rockwell's of the family sitting around the Thanksgiving table with the steaming turkey and the as the centerpiece.
It would be funny to see what the sort of I'm sure someone on the internet has made updated versions of Norman Rockwell paintings
with everybody sitting around the table looking at their devices.
Right. No. Exactly. And then there's like a video of a turkey cooking on YouTube or something. Yes.
And we talked earlier about QAnon and the fact that they showed up at Trump's rally recently down in Florida brandishing their logos. And that was the first time we learned about their bizarre thought patterns, if you can even describe it as thoughts. But I just wanted to go back to what you've written about here in terms of trying to get the attention of journalists. You say the journalists must ask themselves that they aren't just part of the game of media manipulation. They are the trophy. Consequently, before they publish a word, journalists must seriously consider what role they'll end up playing in the narrative and whose work they'll end up doing as a result. And of course, that I think could be encapsulated by the fact that the mainstream media gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising and helped him probably more than anybody, more than Comey and more than Putin, to become a president. So what can we do? I mean, we talked about what the challenges facing consumers and citizens. And frankly, there's been a change underway for decades to turn us away from being active citizens into being passive consumers. That, I think, is the nature of consumer capitalism. But on the other hand, to touch on journalists, how are they going to get themselves out of this trap? It's almost the same trap that the White House press corps is in, where they get lied to every day by Sarah Sanders, and yet they've still got to show up to be humiliated by more lies.
Yeah, it's a really tricky line to walk, and I also place myself in this category as an academic who writes about online spaces and about digital culture. I'm often faced with the question of, well, should I amplify this or not? You know, even if it's a quote unquote good example, what impact will publishing this have? And so I think that the first step is really recognizing that when you're talking about how information flows across social media, it's not just what is in your article in itself. It's not just what your intention as the journalist was. You can have the best intentions in the world, beautifully sourced, perfectly done, ethical, you know, sound in heart, you know, and yet the article can end up having a really negative, even dangerous effect. And so journalists have to ask themselves, what is the potential impact of publishing this information? Because so in the case of QAnon stories, if you have explainers, you know, stories that explain what the conspiracy is said to be and that may include a glossary of terms because they use a lot of insider lingo to talk about the conspiracy, participants do. But if you are a journalist and you're trying to just tell people what's going on and keep the public informed, because that is the ultimate purpose of the institution of journalism, and we need journalism in a democracy, it's important. And so you could, as a journalist, really be doing your best to inform citizens so that they can make a reasonable decision about, you know, whatever action steps. However, online, you just don't know. It's much more difficult to anticipate what your audience will do with information. So for the audiences that already know that that QAnon is not a real thing and there's no deep state and it's not a cabal of pedophiles, like, who already know that those things are not true, explainers can be interesting and helpful to explain why something is false. However, people who don't already know that or who thinks that anything that comes out of a journalist's mouth is a lie to begin with, those kinds of explainers, although they may simultaneously perform an important civic function for certain audiences, can just entrench the story in other audiences or give, you know, media manipulators a jolt of happiness because they tricked this journalist into repeating a story. And so journalists have to take that, essentially a threat assessment model. Will reporting this, does the benefit it could have for my intended audience, is that potentially outweighed by the negative effects that unintended audiences could do with it? And that's a really difficult thing to assess because it's just hard to know. So journalists need, at the very least, the first step is just to do that kind of threat assessment, to think about whose interests their work might be serving, and to think outside of their own intended audience, because that's not going to be the totality of who sees their article. So really thinking in terms of kind of network manipulation and anticipating the unknown, which is a very difficult thing to do, but we have to start doing it to stymie the spread of this kind of polluted information.
Well, just in closing, Whitney Phillips, we are really under attack. We know from the FBI and the national security heads that had a recent press conference, in contrast to the president, who keeps denying Russia's involvement in meddling in the last election, the intelligence community en masse, the heads came forth the other day and said that we are under constant attack. And then the FBI revealed a bunch of Russian bots manipulating, trying to divide, feeding conspiracies to the far right and the far left to further divide these already dangerous fissures in our culture, in our country. So, you know, it's possible, for example, that QAnon could be a Russian bot, right?
It's possible that it can be all kinds of things. There was reporting coming out of BuzzFeed today that there's more and more evidence that suggests it was a hoax to begin with, or at least there was a strong hoaxing element from the outset, which is also the information that I encountered as I was doing my research for the piece. I mean, I think that one of the things that our book does, we wrote this book, it was due to the press, to Polity Press, the day after the election. And we were not expecting the outcome of the election, and so had to make some last minute changes. But it was an interesting process to write. In particular, the fifth chapter, which is on public debate and the sort of the ambivalence of public debate, the same social media tools that can be used towards social justice activism and can really empower marginalized communities can also be the same tools that are used as a weapon against those communities. Both things are true simultaneously. So as we were writing that fifth chapter, things started to get stranger in the election, and the alt-right started to emerge, and there was more and more media manipulation, and things became more and more confusing as a citizen. Even, you know, and I spend all my day, all day long, every day, looking at weird stuff on the internet. So even for someone whose job it is to pay attention to weirdness, it was real weird. And in the book, we talk about the importance of Poe's Law, the axiom I mentioned earlier, where it's just hard to know what you're looking at when you are looking at it. And so it's a reminder for people, everyday citizens, to don't assume that just because something looks a certain way online that it is that thing, because it is not an outrageous suggestion that what you see online could be the result of a Russian computational propaganda campaign, that is part of our political reality now. So it's important to recognize seeing is not always believing, nor should it be, arguably, and that restraint is really an important strategy in responding to media manipulation. Even if you are reacting to something to denounce it, you are still amplifying it, and you don't know what your audience is going to end up doing with it. So people need to also be reflective about what they're sharing, why they're sharing it, and what impact that could potentially have on the overall body politic. So that is one reason that I think the book is salient to our present moment, and also thinking about how the tools of digital media, the affordances of social media, how that lends itself to ethical roadblocks, to the inability to really see others as fully fleshed out human beings deserving of empathy, even if you disagree with them on certain issues. understanding how social media essentially sets us against each other is an important thing to think about and reflect on, especially as we're heading into the 2018 midterms, which are already under siege by a number of media manipulation attempts, including those by Russia. So keeping those two things in mind, I think, are very important, and now we know what we're up against.
Well, Whitney Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.